You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Ryan Walker. In this episode, I'm speaking with Claire Fitchett on human factors and leadership. So this is the second installment of the human factors series that we're running on the podcast. So we're going to explore the fundamentals of human factors and the interplay of leadership. We're going to also examine what human factors mean to Claire and how they affect her practice. We're also going to look at just how Claire perceives leadership can affect human factors and indeed mitigate it. And then we're also going to examine the concepts and strategies of how patient safety is and indeed has been affected in the past from Claire's anecdotal experience of when it's gone well and when it might not have gone so well. And then just her reflections on how she sees it play out on a day-to-day basis. Claire qualified as a paramedic in 2013 after undertaking her student paramedic training in South Central Ambulance Service in the UK. She commenced her specialist paramedic training, so her critical care training, in 2018 with Thames Valley Air Ambulance, and also holds the DIPIMC, so the Diploma in Immediate Medical Care, from the Royal College of Surgeons, and is completing her MSc in Advanced Practice at the moment. Claire is also an exhibition medic with British Exploring and indeed a faculty member of World Extreme Medicine. So she currently works for Hampshire and the Isle of Wight Air Ambulance in the south of England. Welcome, Claire, to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Claire, I just wondered if we could start by just looking at what human factors means to you.
Okay, so I guess certainly I want to say that I'm no expert in human factors, but broadly speaking, I think that it's all things that are non-technical. So actually, we learn the technical bit, the clinical part at university, and as we progress through our paramedic career. But I think it's a combination of everything else that affects our performance. So it's the organisation, the team we're in, and our own abilities to manage other people and stress and complexity in our roles as clinicians.
So it's really interesting you say that, because I think the complexity is a massive piece of that that you just mentioned, because actually we know that the pre-hospital care environment is becoming more and more complex. And actually what we want to do is keep things as simple as possible, actually, so the skill acquisition, or indeed just the end point, is as safe as possible with the worst doctor, the worst paramedic on the worst shift. But it's really interesting you mentioned that complexity, because I think the job of human factors, to your point, is to try and transcend the complexity and come to that predefined endpoint. Just looking at the interplay, so Claire, between human factors and leadership, could you maybe speak to how you see that playing out, maybe good or bad, sort of whereby you see leadership affecting human factors? How does it look in your mind?
So I think that effective leadership and teamwork are essential for that overall team performance. And from an organisational point of view, I think clinical leaders must develop a culture of openness and supporting clinicians when mistakes are made. We know that mistakes will be made, and it's about how we get supported into doing that. So I think if organisations have a culture of openness, then this allows individuals such as paramedics out on the road to lead as they sort of have the organisation support and know that they will be supported if and when they probably make a mistake. I also think that flat hierarchies come into this. It's everyone's responsibility to deliver good care. But in order to do this, we must develop a culture where it's encouraged to ask questions and of more experienced clinicians. And actually, they're then open to discussion about their own clinical practice.
I think that's really interesting you say that, Claire, because like you said, it's about this open discourse and opening. I think it's probably a central piece to working on the air ambulance yourself is having other people, allowing other people to speak into your contemporary practice and your retrospective practice. So through D&D or case review, but also in the moment saying, right, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And actually the mitigation pieces, you know, A, sharing the mental model, but it's like, right, am I missing anything? Because I've just shared everything in my mind with you. And so that mitigation piece is quite powerful, because you might allow me, who's qualified 2 weeks prior to us doing this job together, to go, yeah, actually, is the cap seems to be off that cannula, or it seems to not be flushing properly. You'd be like, great. Yeah, and it's this, it's almost this shared situation awareness through delegating your attention to others. So you just, it's this, yeah, it's this cohesive working principle, which is powerful. And so my next question, Claire, is around sort of seminal leadership points that you perceive to be useful that mitigate human factors. Could you speak to things that you see in practice just on a day-to-day basis where you think, actually, that's really prudent to bring that forward and integrate within your own practice?
So, yeah, of course. I think being able to lead with compassion in the pre-hospital environment is really important. I think by the time I get to scenes, there is usually a critically unwell or unwell patient there. And I don't arrive and take over. I try and listen to everybody on scene. Just like you said, regardless of their clinical grade, I like to listen to what's happened and how I can help. And I think by doing this, it just sets a really good tone when you get to scene, that you're not taken over, that you're here to give you that, to give your skills and your little bit of clinical expertise to that job. I think being able to make a decision is really important, especially with the patients that we see, but not being so stubborn as to change your mind if you have made the wrong one, and allowing people to sort of question what you're doing and why you're doing it is really important. I also think there's the ability to make mistakes and being able to show vulnerability. And I think this comes definitely into my clinical practice at times. And I really believe that we've got to be able to learn from our mistakes, and not just what's gone wrong, but why and how we can change things to make sure that doesn't happen. And I think it's really important actually to know when to be a leader and when to be a follower. There are times when I know on scenes there can be conflict, especially where we try to work in flat hierarchies. But actually, there are times where sometimes you have to be a clinical leader and other times you have to be a follower. And I think it's really important to have the insight to know when to do this and when to lead and when to follow. And I also, on a debriefing point of view, from your point that you said, I think debriefing is really important. So sometimes there just isn't time on scene to explain everything you're doing, explain why you're doing something that they think is slightly differently, the crew on scene think are different, but actually it's part of the debrief that you're able to then share your thoughts and add to that and ask if they've got any questions and be able to explain what you did and why, and more importantly, why you did it.
Listen, that's really powerful. And it kind of answers my next question around good leadership attributes, because I think you really nailed it there. It's learning to be a good follower before you're a good leader. But then when you are stepping into that leadership role, it's orchestrating everything that the team needs from that leader, which is purposeful communication. So closed loop communication, you know, one person, there's macro conversations happening, so everyone's on the same page. To your point, there's overt leadership. So there's no confusion about who's leading the scene. And everyone kind of knows where the flow of communication is going. And then, yeah, everyone's on the same page, but it's happening in sequence, but simultaneously. So there's this semblance that the leader's driving things forwards simultaneously, and actually the end point is achieved a lot quicker, but they're covering off their own weaknesses by going, yeah, Claire, am I missing anything, or Owen, am I missing anything? And I think it's that driving the scene forward with good non-technical skills. And to your point, having that sort of clear overt leadership in place, but again in the debrief as well, because I think to your point, Claire, it's prudent that I think the leader needs to know in the debrief where they can still close the gap and get better. So it's, you said about vulnerability, and I think that vulnerability is absolutely key from a leader, because they can then leverage those learning points and allow other people to speak into their practice.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that the debrief is that vital bit where you learn as well. So actually, as a critical care paramedic, it isn't me debriefing the team of how I think they did. It's actually getting feedback from them and saying, how can I be better? And how can I support you better next time that I come and help you with a patient?
So looking at more sort of supporting junior clinicians to lead in critical care circumstances. So this is always a piece which I think is the eternal struggle, really, because there's always this balance between how much do you let junior clinicians lead and will drive the scene to get the feel for leadership themselves versus how much do you need to step in. But could you speak to that and sort of how you approach supporting junior clinicians to lead?
Yeah, of course. And I think it's a little bit earlier than this. And what I mean by that is I think it's about being a good mentor early on. So when you're given that opportunity to be a mentor, don't take over. People will get there in their own time. So I guess an example of this is history taking. We've all had maybe a student where you are mentoring them and you think that they're taking a little bit too long to get to the points that you want them to get to. But actually, that is okay. We need to be good mentors, sort of like let them do their skills, let them do the history in their own time. And I think that comes with time. I think with the experience, you have more clinical confidence in yourself to be able to mentor others, to let them take the lead. And in fact, and more importantly, stay in the lead. I think from a critical care point of view now, as a critical care paramedic, my advice is to for clinicians, for paramedics, to seek support early and ask for advice. Understand the layers of help they can ask for. For example, in our service, we have the critical care desk where they can speak to one of us and we can support over the phone and sort of use things like the Good Sam app to help them on scene. And so I think when I arrive on scene, I like to support others and not take over. I often leave the person who's leading in charge and ask if I can support them and how I can help them. So, for example, we know that, let's give cardiac arrest, for example, we'll know that we potentially will have two or three ambulance crews there and a team leader. And actually, if they're doing a good job and they're leading that arrest, what a great thing to do. And I often say, thanks very much. You know, what would you like me to do and how can I help you? And it just gives them the empowerment to continue leading that scene. But I think on the flip side of that, we absolutely can't let people fail. So if I turn up on a scene and potentially it's not being run particularly well, and for whatever reason, lots of reasons for that, of course, it's working out to sort of know when to step in and support. So if I feel a clinician is overwhelmed on a scene, on a busy scene, on a scene where a patient is particularly unwell, then I will ask them if I can support them in leading that scene and leading with that patient. And I think this, as an organisational point of view, this needs to be encouraged for clinicians from a really early stage in clinical practice. We often, you know, expect newly qualified paramedics to be out on an ambulance on their own, and they feel like they are on their own and not got other support. But I think we really need to bring that support in from an early stage. So they feel that they can ask for it. But yeah, I think that's how I would try and support clinicians on the road.
So just looking at some of the sort of, I guess, misconceptions or pitfalls really that leaders and or just clinicians fall into around sort of reliance on their own memory, some of the maybe the non-technical mistakes that people make. Could you speak to things that you see in practice, Claire, that maybe on a regular basis that actually could make a world of difference if people approach it slightly differently, and indeed maybe that comes out in the debrief afterwards?
I think as a profession, we sometimes think we have to remember everything and we can't use checklists, for example. When I first qualified, we didn't have the online access to all the information we have available now and had sort of the JR pocketbook. And I think I expected myself to be able to know it and I should know everything. And I put a lot of pressure on myself to remember everything, which obviously you just can't do. So I still see people in clinical practice now who seem to be self-conscious and don't want to be seen to be using checklists. But I think we, as a profession, we need to encourage this from a very early stage and advocate that using checklists in A-memoirs is a positive, safe practice and a sign of a competent, insightful clinician. You know, as a CCP now, I would never do a sedation without a checklist. Not because it's impossible to do it without one, but actually it's not safe to not use a checklist. And I think from sort of general clinical practice, you know, we don't often see maternity cases. We don't often see paediatric patients. And I think we just need to be able to use checklists and use aid memoirs to help our practice and not be afraid to do this. I also think that our memories are particularly bad after an event. I think we only tend to remember the bad things that have happened or maybe that we thought we hadn't done a good job. And we don't often think about what went well. And I think sort of I see a lot of that in clinical practice. And again, hence why I think the debrief process is so vital to sort of complete that job and learn from each other.
I wanted to sort of pivot and just look at the sort of shared mental models and peer review. So the peer review, as you were saying, is around being a good mentor initially, but then when they're a peer rather than a mentor, the relationship changes somewhat actually, but it's still, there's still a chance for feedback there. And you know, very much as a critical care clinician myself, I always appreciated peer review because I'd always learn things from other people's practice. So if I was not leading, but just letting someone else lead and actually seeing how they stewarded the scene. Could you speak to how your system orchestrates peer review and indeed maybe advocates for contemporaneous information sharing like shared mental models? Is that advocated? Is it taught? Is it promoted? And indeed, what's the approach to peer review?
So my opinion of it is that it's vital and highly encouraged in FEM. The service that I work in at the moment, so Hampshire and Isle of Wight Air Ambulance, are particularly keen to ensure peer-to-peer review. And this is done within the service at clinical governance, but also external with the service, with our local ambulance service. And we are sort of highly encouraged to come offline even, to go and do a peer-to-peer review or an after-action review with our clinical colleagues. I guess I have an example of a recent job that I did involving a young child, a 10-year-old, who was unfortunately in cardiac arrest due to asthma. And I talk about peer-to-peer support in that we had a little bit of time before we were being picked up by one of the team to go to scene. And it was a colleague of myself, another critical care paramedic. And we took the chance really to speak to our top cover, to speak to our consultant beforehand. And we just wanted to discuss our plan in a calm and rational way, which I think led to a little bit of increased clinical confidence when we arrived on scene. They were able to sort of confirm that the plan that we thought was the right one and sort of gave us some extra support in things that we also could do if we felt that we needed to. But I think the key to this was after the job, where we all went back to the ambulance station to debrief that together. We were stood down. And it was an opportunity for us all to discuss the job. And actually, we had everyone there, from the call handler to the dispatch team, to the two clinical crews on scene, to the team leader and ourselves. And this after-action review, or the peer-to-peer review, was really instrumental in and I think this after-action review and peer review was really instrumental for all crew members. It allowed us to go through the job step by step. It allowed us to see where we could do better and actually what had gone well. And I really believe that it allowed us all as a wider clinical team to walk away from that job with a huge sense of professional pride, despite a very poor outcome from the job. I think we must always remember to highlight the good practice. It's vital for people's clinical confidence. I think we always focus on the bad points and not the good. And I think this is something that I really want to change in my own clinical practice, is to really highlight what went well as what didn't go well.
Isn't that really powerful you say that, because you're right, well-intentioned and or indeed appropriate affirmation of practice, of skills, of just maybe just how paramedics or doctors or nurses handle a situation, handle a patient, de-escalated a scene, performed the primary secondary survey. So affirmation with a reason for the affirmation, so it's not just for affirmation's sake, is absolutely powerful, because like you said, it can be. And we fall into the danger for it being just about, you know, you're not good enough, or not, you're not, what, you know, what can we do differently? Why are we not good enough, you know, corporately or individually? And actually, you're right, affirmation is a key part of that. I mean, even part of the debrief, it's what went well and what were the challenges. So, you look at what went well first, because I think if you're beating people over the head all the time, and not picking out the affirmative parts of a job that went well, then there's really no equipoise or balance to their learning. and they just feel they come away feeling not good enough. And that's, you're right, that's not where we want to be at all. So I completely agree with that, Claire. And a pivot from that is around, how do you see your own leadership's changed over time, just in stressful situations? If you could, you speak to your practice, Claire, and how, if you were sort of a if you could be like almost an anthropologist of yourself and just sort of observe yourself since 2013, so for the last 10 years, how do you feel like you've changed?
So I'm going to go back to 2003, if that's okay, when I first joined the military. I was taught during my officer training to be a very autocratic, almost transactional leadership style. And really, that's probably what I did throughout my military roles to some extent, because that was just the way that sort of leadership happened. I then sort of commenced training, my paramed training, and then my specialist training in 2018. And actually, I did get some feedback when I first started at Thames Valley Ambulance that I was pretty direct, and I was sort of direct with people on scenes. And I used that. I used that to reflect on what people had said and realise that I needed to change my leadership style. And I feel and I hope I've moved into sort of a more coaching and transformational style of leadership. You know, like I've mentioned before, I really don't like to take charge. I like to be able to support others to do what they're already doing and sort of guide and coach them. I mean, that said, I think there are times when you do need to briefly change your style of leadership. Sometimes we go on complicated scenes. There's lots of people shouting different things, and someone's got to take the lead. And I think it's good to be able to flex that and potentially at times be a little bit more direct and sort of bring that scene back together. And then hopefully I sort of move back into sort of that more transactional bit, that flat hierarchy scene. But it's about getting the balance right. And I think that changes very much, or maybe a job to job basis. I think in stressful situations, I'm very much probably very similar to you. I want to get my shared mental model out very quickly. I like talking and I like cognitively offloading my thoughts onto others. Again, a recent example, I went with a CCP, a critical care paramedic colleague, and myself to a gentleman who'd been stabbed multiple times in broad daylight. And when we arrived, the crew were doing a great job. They were managing the patient, slightly sort of overwhelmed with the amount of wounds that the patient had. And they were trying to get monitoring on, use Celox, and do lots of things all at the same time. And what I did is a colleague and I sort of had decided that I would sort of stand back and sort of lead the scene and they would get involved, so to say. And I shared my thoughts early. So I listened to the handover. And I stated out loud that I thought the patient was peri-arrest, just to bring people into that shared mental model. And I did 10 for 10. So that's sort of 10 seconds for the next 10 minutes. I looked at my watch. I gave a time and said, at this time, I would like this patient to be on the ambulance, please. And I need sort of A, B and C to happen. So I need IV access. I need him to be warmed. I need him to be trauma naked, for example. And I empowered others, sort of asking them to do tasks that I knew they could do, not asking anyone to do a task that I knew they wouldn't be able to do. So, for example, getting the paramedics to cannulate, getting the emergency care assistant to get the warming blankets out and to get the trolley out. And that also allowed us to do what only we could do. So we were able to sort of transfuse him and sort of administer blood. So I think, you know, under stressful situations, it's not keeping everything to yourself. It's offloading that information early. Everyone needs to know what's happening, not just yourself. And actually, I think that does lead to less stressful situations because people will be able to do the things that you ask them to do that way.
So my next question really, Claire, is around because these stressful situations occur in the pre-hospital environment. They're multifactorial, but one of the things that is common is that, you know, environmental factors impinge. So just environmental noise, it might be noise of traffic, it might be noise of the bystanders, it might be the patient or indeed the patient's family, it might be a gang, it might be, but it's just this sense of malaise, well, not malaise, but just absolute noise which can get in the way of communication, which can get in the way of clinical practice, can get in the way of deploying skills, and it's not unique to critical care. It happens across pre-hospital practice, and is a real, can be a real detractor from the scene. But could you speak to how you sort of manage environmental human factors?
So I think this is really tricky. I think we definitely can't control any of the environments we find ourselves in within a pre-hospital care environment. I think an interesting job I had about a year ago was I was driving in my own camper van with a friend of mine who is an emergency medicine consultant and a pre-hospital emergency medicine consultant as well. And we came across an RTC. And it was a patient who was unfortunately trapped in his car in a ditch in peri-arrest. And, you know, that was a really difficult environmental scene. We were not in the appropriate PPE, like sandals and shorts. We had no kit. We weren't able to make the scene safe. And it was quite interesting for me because it sort of took me back to when I first started as a paramedic, when you sort of come across a scene, you're first on scene. I'm not often first at scene, and they're actually being very well managed by my paramedic colleagues. So I guess sort of things I think about when I go into scene is I always think, first of all, how am I going to get out of this scene? Or how am I going to get a patient out? And do, like you just said, do things that need to be done. So if furniture needs to be moved, I start asking other people to move that furniture for me so we can get patients out. Getting 360 access to our patients are really important. If you need to just move, I always think move early. I think you can very easily get yourself stuck in that corner or stuck in that tight space. If you do one thing, such as putting oxygen on, before you know it, you've put oxygen on, you've put monitoring on, you've got IV access. So try to make that space really early. And I guess easy things that we all probably already do in our practice is walking into scenes and putting lights on, turning music off, turning TVs off and making big space, like we said. I think actually on larger jobs, it's actually a lot easier. You can often do more things to manage the environment. Jessup's a good example here with that sort of multi-agency working. So on a scene like RTC, for example, you've got fire and you've got team leaders being able to sort of manage that environment and sort of help you with that. But yeah, I think managing our scenes are definitely really hard pre-hospitally, and we sort of just have to do everything we can to manage that on each individual job.
So my next question is, Claire, could you speak to any great leaders that you've experienced and indeed worked with? I can certainly think of a number where I've just garnered so many elements of received wisdom just from the way they speak, the way they listen, the way they move, and indeed their clinical practice. But could you speak to any sort of great leaders that you've learned from, or indeed that you've learned from their style of mitigating human factors, either individual, task or environmental?
So I have a very personal example, actually. I was deployed to Afghanistan the latter end of 2013, working on the medical emergency response team and taking seriously injured people into the emergency department in Camp Bastion. And we had a DMD, so deployed medical director, who is the most senior doctor in the hospital. At that time, it was a British doctor, an anaesthetist. And he led with such compassion that I was in awe of it. He just demonstrated visible leadership. So every time we went in with a patient, he was there. But he was there in the background. He wasn't leading the trauma teams. He was letting the more junior doctors do that and sort of the consultants do that. But he was there when a sort of decision needed to be made, when a difficult decision needed to be made. He was there to offer guidance to the trauma teams and to the rest of the hospital. You know, there were difficult decisions being made about the care of patients, both military patients, combatants and civilians that were involved. And I just remember watching him and thinking, this is someone I want to be like. I want to be you, and I want to sort of just lead with that compassion and being able to just be there and help you make those really difficult decisions. I think it would be remiss not to mention Martin Bromley when we talk about this. I remember first hearing this sort of 5 years into my paramedic practice and you know what he has managed to do after sort of the sad and tragic death of his wife Elaine. I think the work he's done over the years in healthcare to improve human factors using his expertise from aviation has been extremely valuable. I think I have no doubt that it's improved patient safety and it's helped empower all clinicians at all levels to really speak up when they need to. And I really try to advocate that in my practice, to allow others to speak and to challenge my clinical practice. And I feel I've done that with sort of the support and the guidance that he's been able to help us with.
So, Claire, that's powerful, really. And I fundamentally agree with those points. And I think the work, as you say, the advocacy he's done in the space has been a powerful reminder of how we can learn from failure and produce safe results for the patient. So patient safety guided results and treatment. But so just as we're starting to come to the land of the conversation, Claire, could you maybe speak to a couple of examples from practice, from your anecdotal experience, where things have gone well, and then maybe when things have, where you've navigated and mitigated humor factors?
So I guess an example where it's gone wrong and has had a direct impact on patient care was a time when I was working with a new consultant, someone I hadn't worked with before, and we were called to support a crew with a post-ROS patient. But actually the crew and the team leader on scene hadn't wanted to wait for us to stay, were very sort of keen to go to the hospital. So the consultant and I turned up. There is no shared mental model between myself and the consultant. And they were asking me to do lots of things at the same time. And as a result of that, that led to me to not really communicate particularly well with the ambulance crew. So the team leader was sort of putting a little bit of pressure on us to leave scene. He wasn't necessarily happy that we were on scene and sort of, in his words, after playing, and just wanted to move towards the hospital. And the sort of poor communication led to a breakdown between sort of professional. And I guess the poor communication between the team leader and myself led down to a huge breakdown in communication, to the point that they said they were going to report me whilst we were on scene with the patient. So I sort of politely said, can we talk about this after? And we carried on with the patient and got to hospital and handed over. And so we were all keen to have a debrief at the hospital. And it was a difficult debrief. But actually the sort of salient point was that we hadn't communicated with the team on scene. We hadn't communicated what we wanted to do. And again, more importantly, why we were doing it, that actually we were able to provide that sort of almost ITU level care at the scene. But we hadn't communicated that. And I think it did lead to the patient sort of, they did get care, but it was very clunky and it was sort of very prolonged. And it's sort of something that's always stuck with me after that debrief, is to really communicate what I'm thinking, back to the point that I say about iconically offload what I want to do and why I'm doing it, to allow others to understand what we're doing. A good case of human factors is sort of one that I've mentioned already, with the sort of paediatric cardiac arrest. It was a very poor outcome for that child, but clinically, from a human factors point of view, was a professionally well delivered job. And we were called to scene. The team leader on scene had been liaison with our dispatch team and was sort of getting some advice for them. And we knew what we were going to. We had all the information. We were able to turn up on scene, work out very quickly what they wanted help with, which was the airway. And we were able to give our 10 for 10, share our plan. We were able to sort of ask if anyone had any questions about what we were going to do. And we'd sort of, everyone was on the same page and same sort of mental model. And we moved to ED, so the emergency department, who were very well supported. So the handover was good. The sort of reception from ED was good. We had a hot debrief with a nurse consultant there and then, the whole crew, not just me, so everyone that had been involved in that job. And like I said, we were stood down, went back and debriefed it. And this was really important. So sort of this case was an example of where everyone had come together and everything had worked really well from a human factors point of view. And again, like I said before, the debrief was absolutely vital in allowing every clinician involved in that job to walk away knowing that they'd done everything they can. And for me personally, it was a job that was that gave a huge amount of professional pride in working alongside my ambulance colleagues to deliver the best care we could with everyone doing the best for that patient.
Oh, listen, that's fantastic. And really good to, like you say, see it in practice rather than in theory. But Claire, as we come into land and just finish on the conversation, could you maybe speak to a few seminal take-home points that on human factors mitigation from your practice or indeed your experience that you'd like to leave listeners with?
So I think as clinicians, we must really focus on human factors as well as the technical elements of our job. I have recently undertaken the Strength Deployment Index. For those who don't know about it, it is a way of focusing on what we do, and it helps us understand why we behave and how we relate to each other. And it's done whilst you are sort of working normally and then when you're under high amounts of stress. And I found that really insightful to work out how I am perceived by others and how I come across. And I think it's really important to sort of know that. I also think it's really valuable and insightful to always want to learn, always want to reflect, and to always take feedback, really understand how you come across, take feedback from others, and learn from it and improve as clinicians. We can all learn from each other, and I think this is really, really important as us working in the pre-hospital environment especially.
Listen, Claire, that's fantastic. Thanks so much for your time today. I really do appreciate it. I think we'll put a few links in the show notes to some papers on human factors and indeed mitigation strategies around checklists as well, as you're saying, and the evidence for checklists. But yeah, thank you so much for your reflections.
And thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.